Welcome, listeners, to episode 12 of Know Your Enemy. I'm Sam Adler Bell. I'm here with my podcast co-host, Matthew Sittman. How are you, Matt?
I'm doing great today. What? For a few reasons.
Yeah.
One, it's a Friday in Brooklyn. Yes, I made the trek again, but it is a fucking fantastic November day.
It's truly a fall day.
And we had a wonderful conversation with Rebecca Traister.
Yeah, absolutely. We're hyped up.
Yes. And we're really excited to share this conversation with you. Who is Rebecca Traister? Well, most of you probably are at least familiar with her work. She's a writer for New York Magazine and the author most recently of the book Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. And both her work for New York Magazine and a lot of what's in her book inform this conversation.
Yeah, and I think what was so exciting about having her on is that we have had these conversations in the past about sort of what underlies, what are sort of some of the core kind of motivating principles of the conservative movement, how does it work, and we often come to the conclusion that racism is a really fundamental part of the sort of, when you look under the hood of conservative ideas and politics, you do often confront racism, but you also confront sexism, and there's almost no better journalist to have on the podcast to talk about that phenomenon, especially in the past two or three decades, than Rebecca Traister.
Yeah. And in some ways, the conversation about gender and the right is the more interesting one. And by that I mean the conversation about race, it seems to me this like brute reality. The civil rights legislation passes. There's a wave of backlash.
Yeah.
The whole entire Deep South starts voting Republican.
Yeah.
And by 1980, Ronald Reagan is elected.
Yes.
Whereas the gender conversation, it seems more complicated because most white women, a majority of white women, voted for Donald Trump. Yeah. You have a number of women on the right who are anti-abortion, very involved in the pro-life movement.
Yeah. There's a parallel narrative, which is like the women's movement, 1960s, 1970s, reaction against that.
Yeah, I don't mean to downplay that.
But what Matt is exactly right about, and which we do get into with Rebecca, is like, well, when it became clear that the Republican Party was the party of racism, black people stopped voting for the Republican Party.
Right.
But to my mind, it has become clear that the Republican Party is the party of sexism, but white women at least have not stopped.
Right. There's no equivalent to the fact that 90%+ of African Americans vote for Democratic Party, at least when it comes to presidential candidates.
And obviously, Rebecca Traister is also maybe the best person to talk to about Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
And as you know,
trigger warning for our left-wing listeners.
There's a lot of Hillary Clinton talk, but I think that you'll find...
And some Warren talk. So
quite a lot of Warren talk.
You know, all of you who are skeptical of Sam and I.
but as I think we acknowledge in the conversation and that we go to really nuanced places about, it's kind of ridiculous to try to understand the past 25 years plus of American political history, especially as it relates to women, without looking really closely at Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
Who is this person? What forces formed her? Why was she the one who got to this place of getting closest to the presidency of any woman in American history?
Now, before we get to this conversation, just a few reminders, some housekeeping items. Thank you again to our friends at Dissent for sponsoring the podcast, for all their love and support, helping us promote it, and for offering the free digital subscriptions to those on our who support us on Patreon, who are West Coast Straussian subscribers.
$10 and above.
Yes. So if that induces you to support us, just a reminder about that.
It's still the case that Patreon is what makes it possible for us to do this.
Yes. And also, remember to rate and review us on iTunes. Please tell us everything great about the podcast. And if you don't like something about the podcast, just DM us.
Keep it to yourself.
Keep it to yourself. Just
we do want to know if there's some like great problem with the podcast, but yeah, send it to us in an email or a DM or tweet it at us.
Yes.
Fine.
Anything else, Sam?
No, I think that's it.
But we're very excited about where the podcast is going. Rebecca agreeing to come on was really terrific.
Yeah.
Again,
a coup.
We're very grateful for her willingness to spend a few hours of her Friday talking to us.
Yeah, that's crazy. I wouldn't do that. Well, thanks a lot for listening. And here's our interview with Rebecca Traister of New York Magazine. Okay. Hi, Rebecca Traister. Welcome to Know Your Enemy.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on. You are a long-awaited guest for us because Matt and I both are really big fans of your work, your extensive oeuvre. How's that? How's that, Matt?
That's good.
Matt knows more French.
Barely.
And we're thrilled to have you here.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to do this. We know you're very busy.
Yes, but I'm always happy to talk to you guys.
we heard something about lasagna in your future.
Yes, I'm making lasagna today.
Big lasagna project.
Big lasagna, yeah. Mm-hmm.
One reason we wanted to talk to you was because we thought it would be interesting to approach your work, you know, with an eye on the right and an eye on right-wing reactionary politics. We don't have to, you know, talk only about that, but we did want to tease out how your work relates to the themes of the podcast.
Gender ties into post-war right-wing politics in huge and complicated ways.
Yeah, so yeah. Luckily we have 8 hours to get into every single aspect of that.
Great.
But I guess just to begin with, we would be interested to hear from you just kind of, what's your mission statement lately? Like, what are you doing and what have you been preoccupied with lately?
So very broadly, you know, I cover women in politics, media, and I guess entertainment from a feminist perspective. I think most often I cover women in politics from a feminist perspective. I mean, and it's certainly over the past few years since the 2016 election, I spend a lot of time looking at how gender fits into the political stories and the movements, the social and political movements building around us. And, you know, that takes a lot of different forms. Again, sometimes I'm looking at individual candidates. Sometimes I'm doing media criticism. Sometimes I'm looking at how grassroots movements are forming around conversations and fights around gender. And of course, talking about gender, you're also talking about always about race, sex, class, you know, so basically, yeah. I'm covering politics. It's just that I'm doing it with an eye toward how gender operates in a lot of different directions.
In some ways, it's like incredible that anybody covers politics without that perspective.
Right. Well, that's what I think, right? Uh-huh. And yet, it keeps happening that people cover politics without that perspective.
Yeah, exactly.
I keep thinking, I mean, I first started doing this. I started writing as a journalist about feminism in like 2003, 2004, when I was in my late 20s. And yeah. What that meant, it was extremely rudimentary at the time. And I was doing a lot of pop culture analysis, right? Like, which honestly meant like writing about Britney Spears and Paris Hilton.
Yeah.
And I never thought I was going to be, as a journalist, covering presidential politics. But then a woman ran for president in 2008.
Yeah.
And then a woman, speaking of conservative women, was a vice presidential candidate in 2008. And
yeah. We'll get
and
to that.
So I found myself covering politics. And after 2008, I thought, well, I won't have to do this again, because after Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin and Michelle Obama and all these conversations we've had around gender and race and identity and how they work into presidential politics, everybody in the political media will now better understand how to do this work of looking at context and identity in politics. And then 2016 came around and I was like, nope, that is... As it turns out, we're still not doing it.
It's just an endless return,
yeah,
over and over and over again.
Yeah. Well, Rebecca, one thing there's a lot we can talk about, but since we raised the specter of 2016 here at the start, you know, I was watching a few weeks ago, I couldn't sleep, and I was watching one of those PBS Frontline documentaries about the 2016 race.
Oy.
That's such a depressing way to deal with insomnia. I can't even tell you.
I know. But, you know, when the documentary got to the point in the campaign where it was the second presidential debate, which was the one where Trump brought out Bill Clinton's accusers. Mm-hmm. And then the format was that sort of town hall where they walked around the stage. So Trump was, you know, kind of stalking around and like
looming
over Hillary. And, you know, I really haven't forgotten about that since watching that documentary. Obviously, it was kind of very striking at the time. But, you know, in some ways, that moment in the campaign and the Trump campaign more broadly was kind of the most grotesque and almost a caricature of gender politics, mm-hmm. right? There was nothing subtle about it.
No.
But looking at the Trump campaign and those dynamics in 2016 versus what you covered in, say, 2008, like, was Trump something different, or was he just what had been there all along on steroids?
I think it, as Trump and those who are devoted to him and vocally support him, I think it's a similar dynamic as we've seen around race and mm-hmm. and cruelty, right? Adam Serwer's piece, The Cruelty is the Point. Mm-hmm. So yeah. It's not that it's new. Donald Trump did not invent looming over women and, you know, stalking them in a menacing way. What he did was, you know, take his totally, not only unapologetic, but kind of braying approach to grotesque and brutal traditional gender norms and just put them on display, right? Mm-hmm. So that's what so much of this period has been around the stuff that, you know, and there's a lot of, I think, argument about, did we just learn to be polite about putting our biases right. below the surface, you know, and using nice words, but we retained the racism and misogyny on which this country was built, right? Its very structures were built on a lot of these attitudes, right? But through hundreds of years of social and political and legal reforms, we'd gotten to a place where we'd all decided we had to be more polite about it and put a prettier yeah. face on it. And I know that there's like an ongoing conversation about, like, is it better or worse to have these social norms if the reality is underneath we're still consumed by these sort of biases. But what Trump, what he did was reveal all that stuff that had been under the surface, you know?
Right.
And incidentally, I should say that the thing that was so shocking is that it was her opponent on stage who is doing that, right? But yeah. I want you to consider, like, what was he telegraphing there? Like, his desire to overpower her, his hatred for her, his feeling that, like all those things that we know we sense were being telegraphed when, like, a menacing man sort of violently stands behind you. I have to say, like, it was shocking because it was a candidate for the president of the United States. But we have to remember that that is not that many steps off some of the stuff we heard in 2008 from the media and the attitudes that were reflected, or even in 2016. I mean, I think for a second, there's this thing that happened. It wasn't revealed in 2016, but the tape was, I think, published by my publication, by The Cut, I think in 2017 or 2018, of Chris Matthews, an MSNBC host, making a joke during 2016 about, he was about to interview Hillary Clinton, and he made this joke about, like, I'm going to slip her one of those Bill Cosby pills.
Yeah.
Right? So, okay, that's Chris Matthews makes that joke about a rape pill, like rape. I mean, that was in 2016 too, and that's Chris Matthews. And then if you go back to 2008 and some of the stuff that was just being said very openly, that's my first book was, it was not just about Hillary Clinton, and it was about Sarah Palin and about Michelle Obama and about sort of that, it was misogyny, racism, classism, all for all of, you know, and the paths that all those women took. But when it was very new for a political media to be covering a serious female candidate for president, yeah. there was all kinds of stuff said, you know, she reminds me of my ex-wife,
yeah.
Saying, take out the garbage. She reminds yeah. me of, you know, your everybody's first wife standing outside of probate court.
Right. I was shocked. I shouldn't have been shocked, but I just didn't even know about this. If I had ever known about it, I didn't remember. In Good and Mad, in your book, you reference when Dana Milbank and Chris Cillizza were doing that video commentary thing that they uh-huh. did. And yes. one or the other of them said that if there was a beer summit with Hillary Clinton, or if you went to have a drink with her, this was before the beer summit, but if you went to have a drink with her at a bar, she would have to get the Mad Bitch brew.
Yeah.
Chris Cillizza and Dana Milbank, you know?
Right.
Supposedly tame, middle of the road guys.
Were they both at the, was that for the Washington? I can't remember what outlet they were with at that point, but
they were both with the Post.
With the Washington Post, right? I mean, that was, there was so much of that in 2008. And that's why I say, yes, what Trump did, there was another, that my other one that I sort of still can't believe. It was a comedian, but he was brought on as a pundit. What's his name? Gillette, like Penn and Gillette.
Penn Gillette, yeah.
Penn Gillette, right.
Yeah. He's a terrible libertarian, right?
He may indeed be, but yeah. He was brought on as a pundit, and he said that Obama had done well in February because it was Black History Month, but that Hillary hadn't done well because there's no White Bitch Month.
Exactly.
Oh my God. Yes.
Right. So yeah. I mean, like this, it's just so yeah. It's some of this stuff. Like we actually trick ourselves. This is something we do all the time. All the time. I've just seen it so much around actually harassment stuff. Something like Trump looming over people. I mean, something like the pussy tape itself. We all go, oh my God, it's so shocking. I can't believe it. And then 10 minutes later, when a similar thing happens, we all go, oh my God, it's so shocking. I can't believe it. Like, this exactly. is one of the ways, this is one of the ways we just normalize all kinds of sexism and racism and, of course, class attitudes, where somebody really, like, says the thing out loud and we all behave as though we can't believe that these thoughts still exist. And right. and then the next time, which is usually not that far down the road, that somebody else says something out loud, we don't like take the most recent data point and say, oh right.
Yeah.
And that happened around after the pussy tape, all of the men I spoke to who were like, because of course after the pussy tape, so many women share their stories of being groped yeah. or, you know, and I remember I had a conversation with a senator in the weeks after that, who was like, I had never asked my wife. I didn't realize she's been groped on the subway. I'm like, dude, everybody's been groped on the yeah. subway. What are you talking about? I had no idea how common it was. I had no idea how common it was. Oh, everybody's learning for the first time. They're asking their sisters and their friends and their girlfriends and their wives and realizing all of the women in their lives have been groped. We're so shocked. And then a year later, after Harvey Weinstein, and you have the hashtag MeToo movement.
Same thing again.
The guys are all like, I had no idea. And I'm like, we had this conversation a year ago.
I know. There's no metabolizing of any of it.
No, because people, and that's, look, this is one of the challenges of doing this kind of work and why nobody wants to reckon with it. Nobody wants to have these conversations.
Yeah.
They're not fun and they don't flatter any of us, right? So yeah. why would we want to imbue, like this is why people like me remain at just a giant pain in the ass, because we always sit around and like that's how we get called the scolds, because we're always trying to point out patterns that people fundamentally don't want to absorb as reality. We want to say that all of the inequities that we can reasonably acknowledge are horrific and cruel and unjust, but they're all in our past. We've fixed them. Like that's the only way we're comfortable talking about all kinds of inequity, totally. Especially the kinds that are built into our structures.
Yeah. Well, to follow up from that comment, the way the forgetting you describe, or the kind of, you know, feigned shock and surprise every time one of, you know, a new example of particularly bad behavior emerges. It made me think about a line in your book, Good and Mad, that jumped out at me, which was, you know, and I'm guilty of this myself, the line after the election that, oh, how could Hillary have blown this election to such an obviously terrible candidate? And you made the point that actually Trump was the perfect candidate. It wasn't an accident. That he was actually the perfect candidate to take her on and possibly win, precisely because he tapped into these impulses and pushed these buttons and raised the saliency in a way of the gender dynamics, if that's not too euphemistic, of the campaign. And maybe you could just say a little bit more of that in light of the conversation we've had the last few minutes.
Sure. Well, I mean, and by the way, when I say this, any conversation about 2016 and its result, I think is too often heard either as condemnation or defense of Hillary Clinton, right?
Uh-huh. So yeah, for sure.
To make this point, I want to be really clear. I'm not, there are, you know, 175 factors that went into what happened on that day in November of 2016.
It's overdetermined.
So we're not, I'm not, but by having this conversation, I just want to sort of have a caveat at the beginning saying, I'm not saying like, this is why she lost, right? There are a lot of reasons why she lost.
Yeah.
And she did have real shortcomings as a candidate that I don't, so that the people who say, oh, she really blew it, she should have won this. Like, I mean, sure. Like she should have been a better candidate, you know, she should make all kinds of different choices.
Right.
But it is also true that the idea that she had this easy, like she could just have put him away, right? I think is deeply flawed, because what it doesn't take into account is that the reason Trump becomes the nominee, why does the American right choose Donald Trump in this move, in this moment? And it's, of course, it's not just to be the opponent to Hillary Clinton, who would be the first woman president and who has accumulated so much baggage as a woman who has been perceived. It's so funny. She's perceived in all kinds of negative ways on the left, but like by the right wing over a span of several decades,
yeah,
has gotten all of this super gendered baggage, and accrued so much fear and resentment from a right wing, right? And it's also, it's her, and it's also coming after Barack Obama, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so what are the anxieties that a country that was in fact built, like it's very laws, its courts, its electoral processes, its economy, built on all kinds of structural hierarchies around gender and race. And these are explosive things. Again, here's what goes back to what we talked about in the past 5 minutes, our desire to tell ourselves that we've fixed things, right? Mm-hmm. We elected a black president. We're cool. We're cool, yeah, right? Yeah. Like, we're right, cool. Right. We got over it. That's like, that has real political consequence in a million ways, our desire to tell ourselves that we've fixed the inequities. It's never true. And it anesthetizes us to understanding what's really the kinds of anger and resentments that are still brewing. And this, of course, comes also from a critical left wing that has like real substantive ideological problems with Hillary, but also winds up portraying her as someone who's practically already been president, right? Like she's totally, so establishment. She's so establishment and she's so powerful. Like we, like the left sort of, you know, did a major self-own in behaving as though we'd practically already elected Hillary Clinton because it took away everything. She's already been president.
She's already represents like the evil empire.
Exactly. Because what it drained was the very, was the reality. And this is why I'm glad that there's still a conversation. You know, every time we have anxiety, like the people talk about, like, can we nominate a woman? Because maybe we can't elect a woman. I'm actually slightly grateful for that. Cause I'm like, we should be aware that this is a challenge.
It hasn't gone away.
Yes. Because in this telling ourselves that the left tells itself a fairy tale, which is that like, we've done the work, like, we're cool, we're woke, we fixed it.
Exercised our demons.
And it screws the left because we do not understand the resentment on all everywhere, right? I'm not saying that those resentments are exclusive to a right wing, but the persistent realities of racism and sexism and how they permeate all of the attitudes and the stories and the frames that we put around candidates. So given that in the wake of two terms of Barack Obama, our first black president, without understanding the degrees of resentment and sort of shock to a nation's system it is, and the level and intensity of racist resentment that having been led by Barack Obama produced in certain sectors, right? And also a left that wanted to behave as though Hillary Clinton wasn't really a historic first,
right?
Because she was just representative of like corporate capitalist feminism that had already exercised too much power and was a member of the elite class. And while there are merits to all of those kinds of analyses of her position class-wise, it took away from like, no, we've literally never done this before, guys. Never done it. And it's a unique situation. And there's an enormous amount of gendered resentment that is built up against this woman that is seriously going to come into play. And also it leads us to underestimate the power of Donald Trump. I mean, that's the whole thing. Everybody who says he was a legendarily bad candidate doesn't understand that we were legendarily bad at acknowledging the amount of racism and sexism that was building that resulted in his nomination to begin with.
Right, right, right. If you build up, if we build up our candidate as like already the person in power, that necessarily diminishes the person that she's running against.
Right. And we can still only see Donald Trump. I still see this every day.
He's still an underdog.
As this, like, he's a trash fire. He is all those things. I get why people, right? Like, I agree. He's a disaster. He's incompetent. He's a mess, right? And it is true that he is historically unpopular. Those things are true. But we refuse to see what his strength is, which doesn't mean saying he's some sort of secret genius who's successfully manipulating the media. What it means is that his popularity stems from really serious attitudes that are extremely and intensely felt in his base.
Yeah.
And those attitudes are super real. And a lot of them are around racism and sexism.
Yeah. One thing, we could go on about this particular thing forever, and I know Matt has a different question, but one thing that you and I have actually talked about, this is Sam, once before, is that people really have an unwillingness to historicize Hillary Clinton, you know, so that like the left wants to build her up into this pure, clear representative of just elite policymaking and executive power. But they're unwilling to just sort of acknowledge, we, the left, are sometimes unwilling to acknowledge that the atmosphere in which everything that has happened to Hillary Clinton, mm-hmm. and everything that she's ever done, the atmosphere in which that has happened is the deeply rooted sexism that is fundamental to the way that this country operates. And if you do that, what happens is people feel that what you're doing by acknowledging that is that you're exonerating her for some kind of, for her ills, for something that she's done wrong.
Yes.
But like political analysis and historical analysis isn't a project in either like absolving somebody or indicting them. You know, you're just doing political analysis. You're acknowledging that there's something around this, that there's a terrain on which this woman has lived her life and had the particular career that she's had.
Well, that's sort of been my sort of life's work with regard to Hillary Clinton, into that part of my life's work. It really was trying to take a look. And I've gone in my lifetime, I've been all over the place with Hillary Clinton. Like when she was a senator of New York and I lived in New York, I couldn't stand her. And I didn't support her in 2008. I was actually a John Edwards supporter. And then I found myself as a young woman, totally shocked by how I saw her presidential run being treated. All of this, like I've been all over the place with Hillary.
Yeah.
But, fundamentally my job has been, wait, this is a really unique figure in America's political history, and people are not doing the work of looking to understand how gender was a massive factor in how she became who she is, right?
Right.
And how do you become Hillary Clinton, like in the negative ways as well as the positive ways? She is made and forged by all kinds of attitudes around her gender. And I just had this conversation with Corey Robin, actually.
Big fans of Corey Robin on this podcast. You'd be shocked to know.
I'm shocked to know. So I just did an event with him about his Clarence Thomas book. And he talked about how he always, like how he's regularly sort of, people are assuming that he's somehow defending Clarence Thomas, who of course politically, he's opposed to on every single level, right? Politically and ideologically. But what he's doing around Clarence Thomas in looking to his roots, you know, with sort of a black power ideology, and Clarence Thomas's real roots on a black left, you know, is so fascinating.
And in like, you know, the Jim Crow South and being subject to that.
Yes, exactly. And how race and racism formed Clarence Thomas in ways that we, like those of us on the left who are fierce critics of Clarence Thomas and his role and his jurisprudence, like, are made very uncomfortable by thinking about the kind of how his attitudes around race got formed, and that they might have anything in common, at least at their root, with how some of our attitudes and our education around race. Anyway, Corey was talking about, you know, the sort of anxiety around, is he doing a defense when in fact what he's doing is an excavation and an attempt to explain and understand. And I said, this reminds me so much of how I feel about Hillary Clinton. Now, I like her a lot more. I don't want to pretend that as he is to Clarence Thomas, right? I actually do. I on many levels, I'm deeply critical of Hillary Clinton. I deeply admire her, right? And I'm much more positive about her than he is about Clarence Thomas. But I also had that experience of when my job over many years was to write about how she became who she is in ways that were sometimes quite sympathetic. And it was always understood as knee-jerk defense and fangirling stuff. And that was always, I understand why, because we actually don't want, like, the people that we want to not like, we want to not like in pretty simple and clean ways. And we don't want those mucked up by thinking about how they might have become the people we don't like.
Yeah. That's sort of the project of our podcast also.
Right.
We talk about people we don't like all the time.
And I've had it around Sarah Palin. I mean, look, I can't stand, there's no one I would, I mean, Sarah Palin is this one example. There are tons of conservative women. I mean, I think about it all the time.
We're going to get to them for sure.
Well, Rebecca, when Sam mentioned Mad Bitch beer earlier, I didn't want to let that moment slide, because I wanted to say that, you know, I would love to get a beer with Hillary Clinton, actually.
Like you would enjoy a beer with Hillary Clinton, I have to say.
Yes, exactly. That's my strong sense, that I would really enjoy that. And partly I would want to say, like, okay, like, you're not on TV. It's just us. Like, level with me. Tell me about, you know, what the hell it was like when you were First Lady of Arkansas and, you know, the ringer she was put through there. You know, I think a lot of, well, at least my view of Hillary was that she had been, that some of what she was being criticized for and the persona that had she had, you know, developed and constructed over the years was because of these very difficult things she had experienced.
Formed in the crucible of American sexism.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to talk about Elizabeth Warren some, mm-hmm. too, mm-hmm. because your profile of Elizabeth Warren recently at The Cut was just fantastic,
yeah,
on her as a teacher and educator. I think it was the best thing written about her so far this kind of cycle. But I did have a question about her specifically, but it connects to Hillary, and I want to give credit. Before this interview, I was talking to my friend Dorothy Fortenberry, who's a writer for The Handmaid's Tale. And I said, Sam and I were going to talk to you. And I said, well, what should I ask her? And so I just want to give her credit for this question. But it's about the question of plans and gender. And, you know, I think there is something of a conventional wisdom that candidates should be like vague and inspirational and not to commit to too many details because you might be called on them later, or you might have to, you know, tack to the center or do this and that. So for all the differences between Hillary and Elizabeth Warren, you know, different biographies, different politics, different affects in some ways, you know, what do you make of the plan stuff? In your profile of Warren, you get at what a great communicator she is and, you know, the kind of a teacher. But is it also a kind of branding, like a mm-hmm. political branding? Is it saying like, oh, we have to take the ego out of these women candidates? So you're mm-hmm. not voting for her, you're voting for the plans. Mm-hmm. Is it a way of proving themselves?
So there are a million different factors, you know, sort of almost every one of them surely tied to gender, mm-hmm. around this question of planning and competency. Okay. Yeah. Because the most basic and rudimentary is, for a long time within a realm of public and political life, and we're talking very broad brushstrokes here, but in fact, broad mm-hmm. brushstrokes are kind of like what, consider the broad brushstroke of we've never had a woman president, right? That's a big mm-hmm. broad brushstroke. Yeah. Okay. So we're going to go with broad at the beginning. So one of the arguments about women in politics, or even an unconscious bias, it's been a long time since we've heard anybody make this argument out loud, is that women are fundamentally lightweights. Right? Mm-hmm. That they don't have the sort of policy chops, that they don't have. And again, like, this is an old fashioned version of this, right? But that's, you have to imagine that women who are Hillary Clinton and Elizabeth Warren's age grew up within an era in which the assumption about women was that they are not sort of built for public policymaking, right? Mm-hmm. And that permeates in much more subtle ways still all the time. But you have, women are, I think all of us, not just those who want to be president of the United States, a lot of us are trained that if we're, like, really from infancy in any context, if we want to be taken seriously, we have to fight real hard to prove that we're serious.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I think that is, there has to be proof of competency.
Mm-hmm.
No woman, and then when you get to political life, no woman gets away with not having an answer to this thing that she's saying, right? Lots of men actually do. Bernie can say, like, well, I'm not going to draw this out to every penny, which he basically did just say within the past couple weeks. He mm-hmm. always says that, right?
Yeah.
And by the way, that's cool, right? Like, I don't think that's bad. Well,
there's a good political argument for doing it that way.
Of course.
But it might be only available to men.
It is only available to certain people. And you can see that when Warren briefly popped her head up as a front runner over the past few weeks, what she immediately got hit with is, she's vague, she's dishonest, details, how are you going to pay for this? You're lying if you can't say you can pay for it, right? She's getting this ringer that actually comes down to, we don't believe you can do this. We don't believe, right? So she doesn't get to not have the plan.
Right.
But then Hillary also had plans, right? Hillary, but these are also who they are as people. There's another politician I think of around this, Stacey Abrams. Stacey Abrams will tell you, and I've written a lot about Stacey, like she will tell you she's had a spreadsheet since she was in college. Okay. She does. She has plans for everything. This is a public, when you said something about brand, think of Tracy Flick. All right. Because that was the hit back in 2008, there was actually this video made of Hillary. It's Hillary and Obama. And I write a lot about this in my book about that election. Obama was this incredible orator, right? And we all remember, you know, he could go and make beautiful speeches and they were gorgeous and valuable. And I wouldn't take anything away from them, right? He won. He became the first Black president of the United States of America. Yeah. And it was on beauty and feeling. Okay.
Right. Right.
And then Hillary would go in and Hillary would talk to you about policy. And there was a video, it was a Slate video that was made that was amazing. And it showed Hillary answering questions at town halls for like every answer to a question would be 10 minutes. And she would go piece by piece, piece. And the video was of people falling asleep. And it compared her to Tracy Flick in this.
Tracy Flick from the movie Election.
From Election, who's this
Reese Witherspoon character.
And it's a really negative caricature of white female competency. Hand in the air, right? There are others. It's Hermione Granger, who's a kind of a reclamation of that. Somebody once said to me about Hillary Clinton, Margaret from Dennis the Menace, which is a really old fashioned version of this, but it's that hand in the air. Ooh, I know the answer. And so women for a long time have in public life, and this isn't just in politics, have been caught in this double bind. They're either considered airheads, like they don't have the gravitas that was used about Katie Couric, right? When she was going to take over when women didn't host the evening news because they didn't have the gravitas, right? So they're either lightweights, or if they prove they're not lightweights by like having the answer, having the plan, then they're Tracy Flick.
They're boring.
Boring. They're people fall asleep. They're like ass kissers, brown nosers, like, you know, and it's a terrible other caricature. So here's what Warren, and that's happened to Hillary. And of course it happened to Hillary against Bernie too in 2016 to some extent.
Maybe you'll have to write a book, your next book called Good and Competent.
Right. Well, no, but this is, so one of the things about Warren that's fascinating to me is that she is really wrestling with a lot of this stuff. Like, I think she's consciously thought about a lot of this stuff, or somebody on her team has, because she really did come out of the gate embracing the plan thing as a kind of, and it's interesting because it's happened at the same time this past summer, I think, A.O. Scott in the New York Times wrote a look back at the Tracy Flick caricature and how negative it was. Like, we're beginning to do some of the broader work of like examining our biases against, for example, competent women. And I see Elizabeth Warren working that in, saying, you know what, I'm going to run with it. I'm going to run with the nerdy girl in the air, nerdy girl with a hand in the air cartoon.
Yes, but, you know, it's interesting to me. I agree with your assessment that she must be really thinking through this carefully, or that, you know, her team is, you know, worked through this, because it's interesting that the plan stuff is connected to big structural change. So it's, her message to me is very interesting because it's promising that she's going to fight hard, right? She talks about fighting a lot. Why she gave an answer in one of the first debates about, you know, why would you even bother to run if you didn't want to do big things? And so she has this message of big change, of fighting hard, of, you know, rooting out corruption, but it's tied to, I actually have a way of doing it. I know what I'm doing. And so that seems to me maybe something where she differentiates herself a little bit from Hillary. She's keeping the competency in plans, but she's married it to this very inspirational kind of message of big change.
Right. And I think so I actually profiled her in 2017, this summer. No, 2018. Mm-hmm. I wrote a long sort of more, this, the one that you made reference to a few minutes ago was just about her teaching career. And it was this summer, 2019. In 2018, I wrote a more traditional profile of her. It was before she announced for the presidency, but it was very clear that she was going to run. And she was traveling the country. And of course, one of the other things I look at is the sort of contemporary, you know, resistance movement, you know, use the sort of generic term for it. I've been very interested in the grassroots energy and fury. I wrote a book about women's anger as it has, you know, propelled social change throughout the country's history and as it has sort of raised its head since the Trump election. And Warren was out there, and that was much more of a fight. When I was doing that, it was exactly what you're talking about. We are in a fight. She was obsessively talking about we were in a fight. She was one of the first people, even when a lot of the country were still asleep on the Kavanaugh nomination, she was out there saying, we're in a fight. We're fighting this. We're fighting this. Her willingness to be pugilistic. And I think her willingness to tap into some of that stuff, like the energies of people who want to be aggressive in this moment, feeding her belief that she can push for big structural change. Right. Mm-hmm. So she is marrying all these things, the competency level with what she, I do believe, understands is an energy to fight back.
We're a notorious pro Warren for our lefty Bernie bro fans, Warren apologists podcast.
Right. We're squishes.
Yeah.
Rebecca, since this is the first time we've spoken, I'm an ex-conservative mm-hmm. myself.
Yeah.
I grew up a young conservative, and like in my early 20s, especially was, you know, very involved in the kind of right-wing intellectual circles. And so I have a special fascination for Warren as someone who used to be a conservative, or at least was a registered Republican and, you know, in her academic circles was involved with law and economics and some things like that. And, you know, this might, talking about this a little bit might let us transition to some of the women on the right. Mm-hmm. But while we're on Warren, I was interested in your read on her change over time. Mm-hmm. And you know, I guess sometimes I look back and I think, well, are we overstating the degree to which she actually changed her mind? You know, was it a fairly nominal affiliation with the Republican Party? Or, you know, so there is another part of me, though, that thinks when she undertook her work on bankruptcy mm-hmm. and kind of realized some of her assumptions were incorrect, maybe that produced a real change in a worldview that maybe it didn't happen all at once, maybe it happened over time. But, mm-hmm. you know, once you realize that people suffer and struggle for reasons that are different than you assumed, that can have a deep, that can have a very radical change on your basic worldview, I think.
Yeah.
Right? That's one of like the key constituents of how any of us view the world. It's like, why is this person suffering and struggling?
Right.
Did they bring it on themselves? Did they earn it in a sense? Or
did they not?
Did they not?
Yeah, I think that's the piece that for, I mean, my understanding, having spent, you know, certainly spent a lot of time reading her books and her own accounts mm-hmm. of this. And
sometime with her.
And over the years, actually, yeah, she's probably, she was the first real political profile I ever wrote in fall of 2011 for the New York Times Magazine. I don't think it went well for either of us, but and the way she tells this story is, she thinks she knows the answers about bankruptcy. And especially, I think, coming from a sort of conservative worldview around money and her own family's like attitudes about pull yourself up, bootstraps, you know, come on, we can get out of this. She goes in as a law professor with questions about bankruptcy that she assumes she knows the answer to. And then there's an anecdote, I hope I'm getting this right, in one of her books where she has a bankruptcy expert in her class. And mm-hmm. she turns to him and says, so why, you know, how do we know how these families have gone bankrupt? And he doesn't have the answer. He's saying it's their, you know, profligate spending and their, you know, their sort of levels of irresponsibility or whatever his argument is, a fundamentally conservative argument about bankruptcy. And she goes right now and tell the class how we learn this, how you learn this, not questioning his mm-hmm. result, but how did you find this out? And there's this moment of realization that he doesn't know. The guy who's the expert in bankruptcy actually doesn't know how people are going bankrupt. And this prompts her to find out. And it's that process of discovery and having all the attitudes that she was raised with and had absorbed, realizing that in fact, this was not the story of bankruptcy and therefore the story of economic injustice in this country. That path to sort of left-wing radicalization, whether you want to call her a radical, but like the process of radicalizing yourself in a direction that's opposite from the one in which you sort of were raised. For her, I think she comes by it. It makes perfect sense, that trajectory. When you start looking at the stories, you start looking at the actual information, you know, you suddenly realize that the world looks entirely different.
And one of the things I found so interesting in your book, In Good and Mad, you compare or you talk about Hillary's 2008 campaign and how, you know, Mark Penn told her you can't run as a woman, right? Yeah. You have to run as the most competent, the right person for the job. Mm-hmm. Play down the woman thing as much as possible. And of course, there's all kinds of consequences of that. You know, it's one of the reasons that we as you have tried to intervene in undermining this narrative, that was like there was the historic ascendance of Barack Obama, and then there was Hillary Clinton, as opposed to there was the historic ascendance of Barack Obama, and also a woman won a Democratic primary for the primary election, you know, individual primary election in a state for the first time in American history. And no one was like, wow, an amazing thing. You know, some people were, you were.
No, people literally didn't report on it. I didn't know. I read about women in politics. I didn't know it was the first time a woman had won a primary.
Right. Yeah, so, and part of that, obviously, sexism and everything, but part of that is also they suffered because Mark Penn said, don't run. You're not a woman. You know, you're not a woman for the purposes of this candidacy. But then what's interesting is that you move in your narrative from that moment to Palin, right? Hillary's out and then Palin is in. And then Palin also cultivates, after they lose, cultivates these Tea Party women candidates who she calls her mama grizzlies in the 2010 midterm. And they are running as women, but what kind of women? And I'm just really interested if we could have you talk about that stuff and sort of that move from Hillary 2008 to Palin to the Tea Party women in 2010.
To Palin saying, remember her line from her convention speech, what's the difference between a barracuda and a hockey mom?
What is it?
A barracuda doesn't wear lipstick. Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Right, exactly. Okay, so this is a beautiful, exactly. This is a beautiful question. But like everything, it's so complicated. Okay, so first of all, let's start out with Mark Penn was a name, all right? That said, like Mark Penn was a terrible advice
piece
giver,
of shit.
Like bad.
Right. In addition to being a bad strategist, a piece of shit.
So, okay. So, and that advice was ludicrous. However, let me just have a little tiny asterisk to say that it didn't come out of nowhere, right?
Right.
Because it returns us to the broad brushstroke of we've never elected a woman president. Like sometimes I say, you just have to be, you have to remember that at this point, we're like in our third century as a country. We've never had a woman president or vice president. Okay.
Probably not an accident.
Right. So you do have to think like, okay, you're going to do this again. We can't just pretend like, no, we're cool now with this. We're cool. Right. Like that's an error too. So
of course,
Penn is an idiot, but the advice about how to handle the fact that she was a woman.
Right. Who knows?
Right. There wasn't actually, there still is not, let's be clear, a playbook for how to do this successfully. Because nobody's ever done it successfully. Okay.
Right.
So you got to come up with something, right? You got to have a plan. In his case, the plan to de-emphasize her gender. At this point, the only other woman is Shirley Chisholm in 1972. And I should say, we mentioned that Hillary Clinton won a primary. Shirley Chisholm won a primary in New Jersey. It was not all of her competitors were on the ballot. So it sort of has an asterisk by it, but she won a New Jersey 1972 primary. And
such an incredible figure that should be more recognized. And when we think about the history of the Democratic Party and the left.
Right. And again, that it didn't totally count because it was uncontested by some of her opponents. But anyway, except for Shirley Chisholm, who's come the closest, a lot of women have tried to run for president. Shirley Chisholm in 72 gets the convention. You know, then you have a couple of other people who's including Elizabeth Dole on the right. And Pat Schroeder on the left, who sort of think about running, but don't get very far. Hillary Clinton is come in, and people inanely say she is the inevitable candidate. That was always a stupid thing to say. It is 100% always stupid. They said it in 2008. They said it again in 2016. Okay. So how do you run? And one of the anxieties here when it comes to this vector of like gender, being a woman, not just gender, because of course gender plays in for men too, being a female candidate and what you do about that depends on where you stand with regard to questions of gender and power. So if you are perceived to be on the side of a gender insurgency, i.e. feminism, a set of ideas, policies, and beliefs that women should have more economic, social, sexual power, and that then inherently men should have less, then you are perceived as disruptive, like dangerous, in some ways. And so there is, I understand, while I think Mark Penn gave shitty advice, I think that it's not crazy to me that there would be anxieties about de-emphasizing. I hear it all the time now from people approvingly about Elizabeth Warren saying she's not talking about being a woman, which, by the way, I don't think is true. I think she is talking about it in a very fascinating and nuanced way. But that's the impression, that she's not out there doing yet like any of the stuff that Hillary did in 2016, which was like, I'm playing the gender card or whatever, right? But that's because to focus on your own gender, which is in itself a disruption of, you're fighting to be a president. It is displacing a man from that spot, right? These are very real concerns and anxieties and resentments built. However, if you are a woman whose ideological commitments are on the side of maintaining traditional power structures with regard to gender, race, you know, and economic distribution, then you
and the family,
all of it. Well, that's all tied into, right? Like, so the traditional order of things, and that's part of what your very policy ideas and ideology are built around. Then you are a tremendous asset, and your gender is a huge asset because you are the woman willing to fight the anti-feminist fight. You are, rather than have it be just the party of bad white men, like this is one of the rewards that have always been on offer for white women willing to support a fundamentally conservative white patriarchal capitalist line, right?
Yeah.
And among those rewards for people like Sarah Palin, Phyllis Schlafly, Nikki Haley, you know, is the idea that your leadership and even your gender is going to be celebrated by your party, right? And so Palin is free to do a couple of things as a candidate who is representing a deeply conservative ideology. She is free to emphasize her gender in a way that is super traditionally feminine and feminized, right? So play up youth traditional standards of beauty that she embodies, be flirtatious, talk about lipstick, all this stuff, right? And have it be part of a brand. And in fact, for other reasons, I've just been remembering comments that were made in 2008 about Sarah Palin by Donnie Deutsch. And this is like mind blowing because he's remains a pundit on television who talks to us about our elections. Yeah. And, but in 2008, he said that that Palin represented a new feminist ideal. Okay. Oh, in that, gosh. And this is real. She was the kind of woman that he wanted to wake up next to in the morning. And that she was the kind of woman that he wanted watching her kids. And his argument, which he made at length, was that this is what feminists have always failed to be, is that traditionally idealized view of white womanhood tied to maternal expectation and aesthetic and like sexually aesthetically pleasing, you know, as determined by on a scale of Donnie Deutsch white men, right?
Yeah. The one thing feminists have done wrong is not support upholding everything that feminists have tried to dismantle.
Challenge, right, problematize, right. But that's key to like, so Sarah Palin gets to be super feminized and is encouraged to be flirtatious and maternal and talk about, at the same time that she's also encouraged to do something else that's really hard for women on the left, which is to be, to paint herself as aggressive and vicious.
Right.
So the pit,
right?
The barracuda,
the pit bull, the hockey mom pit bull is all built. The guns shooting wolves from the sky, right? Like
grizzly mom,
mama grizzly.
Yeah.
Okay. Like here's the thing: if you are a woman who is on the side of a more revolutionary politics, a disruptive politics, one that seeks to break existing hierarchies and make them more, you know, redistribute resources, then you are inherently an ideological threat. And therefore, you want to de-emphasize all the ways in which you are a sort of communicative threat, right? You don't want to talk about yourself. Right. It's like, you don't militarize yourself. You don't turn yourself into a wild animal. You don't brag about, you know, and I mean, we're seeing Warren push at that with her desire to talk about fighting, right? Like that actually is, she's doing a lot of things that break a lot of the sort of assumptions about what you can and can't do. But
But she's also a grandma and
exactly.
a dog owner.
Exactly. She's dressing up the dog as Two Pennies last night. She did it.
Yeah. It is interesting that it seems like the young, far left progressive, like the squad, mm-hmm. to use the worst term in American politics, they are pushing up against that. You know, they're pushing the boundary
they
further.
They absolutely are.
I mean, especially, and when they do, everybody freaks out. You know, when Rashida Tlaib said,
impeach the motherfucker.
Impeach the motherfucker.
Right.
We went right. crazy, even though everybody, the whole Democratic Party agrees with that. Impeach the motherfucker.
They are picking up on something. So part of what I write about in Good and Mad is about a sort of break in the space-time continuum.
What happens after Trump?
When you have a lot of women being very open about their level of fury against all sure. sort of public censure, telling them that they're not supposed to be portraying themselves as like fierce right. and vengeful and like full of aggressive energy. What you've had is the breakthrough of a lot of that kind of sentiment that has
yeah.
permitted, that has, and because a lot of them are women who went on to be elected, you have an expansion of communicative possibility. But Sarah Palin, this is very new, and we're still trying to contain it. Remember that we're also like
yeah.
in a moment in which there's a lot of anti-feminist backlash and a lot of people coming to tell us that Me Too has gone too far and that like, you know, anger is bad for us and all this stuff. It's a very tense moment where there's a lot of desire for women who are angry on the left to really express that in its fullness, and also a lot of pushback against them, telling them that they're hurting some greater project. But mm-hmm. on the right, mm-hmm. all of that stuff is permitted and encouraged. Look at Joni Ernst, my favorite political ad of all time, who bragged about cutting balls, right? Joni Ernst yeah. did a political ad about castrating sheep, okay? Like, this is the perfect encapsulation of what you're allowed to do on the right, okay? If you are fundamentally supporting a white supremacist, misogynistic, capitalist set of ideas, then you are allowed to brag about removing testicles, okay? But that's imagine incredible. If what yeah. you are pushing on the left is a feminist, anti-racist sort of agenda that also challenges capitalism. And then you try yeah. to make a joke about cutting somebody's balls off.
Castration.
That doesn't go over super well, okay? And that's what, and by the way, yeah. that think about, think for a second about Hillary Clinton, who didn't, right? People on the left talk about Hillary Clinton as if she was a centrist, but she was discussed on the right as if the thing about Hillary Clinton was the nutcracker in 2008, right?
She's the nutcracker,
the whole
yeah.
right wing view of Hillary Clinton was that she was a castrating bitch.
Yeah.
And that's without having been
so careful.
As yeah. like the left thinks she's basically a Republican, but the right thinks she wants to cut their balls off.
Yeah. Okay, because this is sort of in the spirit of the podcast. I'm gonna press you on sort of conservative mm-hmm. womanhood
yeah.
a little bit. Because there's a way in which the way that you're describing it, it overlaps with the thesis about like working class voters as being false consciousness. Right,
like yeah.
you can disagree with that characterization of what you're describing, but that conservative women politicians benefit from their supporting the maintenance of the status mm-hmm. quo, that seems to be clear. But something we do try to do in the podcast is like, what is the appeal of conservatism to women voters? And like, I guess where I'm going with this is like, there is a genuine feeling of wanting to protect some kind of idea of the home, of place, of localism, of like the relationship between mothers and their children, mm-hmm. and that there's something about the way that the world is working now that is undermining these ties and the ability to live one's life according to that. You know, and it's interesting too, because, you know, we have Elizabeth Warren, you know, the right really enjoys the book, The Two Income
right.
Trap. Some people yeah. on the right. And so like Tucker Carlson is a big mm-hmm. fan of that book. And obviously, like, I'm sort of pointing towards the fact that there actually is language on the left to appeal to that same thing, as long as it's not imposing it upon women who do not want that, or who want to have the options about whether they are an ideal mother or
right.
a person who is not, doesn't bear any children. But so maybe I just, that was a bunch of different
okay,
words.
Okay, well, let me say that, I mean, I think that I think it's always been a failure of left communicative will
yeah.
to not wrest the language of family, home, and hearth from the right. You know, that's certainly been true within within an abortion, a conversation around abortion, right? Where, to my mind, and reproductive justice movement has been much better about this always from its inception, has been about health, family, all of it. And that's, you know, that should have been the language of what instead became a pro-choice movement from the start, right? Is to have, you know, we should have rested that language of family away. Because I, of course, see the left's commitments in terms of policy and ideas as being entirely around protection of collective community and familial good, right? And it's as completely moral and familial and in its desires. So I think that there's a communicative error that exists, first of all.
Right.
The second thing about, you know, the next thing I would say about women on the right, you know, when I'm arguing that they are fundamentally on the side of a set of ideas that maintain a status quo, that's certainly by no means suggesting that everybody is casting a vote out of their own personal misogyny, racism, the false consciousness, all that stuff, right? There's often very local and personal circumstances that lead them to either support one candidate and be suspicious of other candidates. But we know that things like both racism and sexism don't just come down to individual intention, right? When I'm making that argument, I am making it about the set of ideas that are represented by the parties and the set of policies that these parties are working to enact. And I do view those structural realities as inherently built around unequal gendered, racial, and economic hierarchies, right? So to cast a vote for that party means to cast a vote for those ideas, even if your own internal ideas that motivate you to cast that vote aren't rooted in misogyny and sex and racism. But what I will say, the other thing I would say is that there is a lot of conversation that I often sort of find myself in when I'm making this argument, which is about false consciousness, that women on the right are fundamentally voting against their own interests when they cast a vote for Republicans who would limit their ability to control their own reproduction or their ability to enjoy any kind of economic parity in the public and professional sphere, that they're working against their own interests. But one of the things about the complexities of white capitalist patriarchy is that, first of all, the white supremacy part of it means that very often they're working in their own interest, right? Because they're what, like the vast majority of women on the right are white women who are actually actively working in their own interest as white women. And the way that patriarchy works is it creates a dependency relationship. So to cast votes that in some way you imagine might be good for your family can mean casting votes that you imagine being good for
your white family,
white men's economic professional prospects in a way that is going to benefit you too, right? And in fact, because so much about the patriarchal structure leaves women dependent on these men, right? Leaves women dependent on men in very real lived ways. Not like, no, I'm going to go out and get it. Like I'm a, you know, 40-year-old mother of two who, you know, and, you know, in a different world, I'm going to go out and become a well-paid computer programmer. Like, that's not real. You know, that's not.
And that's part of the reproductive justice critique.
Exactly. You know, there are lived realities that actually make patriarchy make sense or rather and white support, like in terms of the lived reality of a lot of this stuff makes internal calculus around who am I going to cast a vote for, the person who promises to return my husband's industry to power, you know, who promises that, you know, and also to listen to a lot of the arguments about who's benefiting that's not me and my family. The very realities created in a white capitalist patriarchy mean that people who live within that system find that system their reality and therefore making sense on some level to cast the votes in support of its continuation. So that's the sort of broader response to, is this false consciousness? No, in many cases, these women are voting in their own interests, you know, and have been very active. And it's not just being led by their husbands, right? Now, there's an element of that that's real. Like I've heard there's fights about that, right? Oh, anybody, like women who vote this way are just doing it to please their husbands or whatever. And no, nobody wants, like that's not a full story, but that's also not to say that that's never true, because sometimes it is true.
I mean, if you've ever been canvassing,
yes,
you know that you get the husband at the door and they say, oh, we're both voting, blah, blah,
right,
for
right,
we're both voting for Trump.
Exactly.
And it's like, okay, well, actually, I need to talk to your wife.
Right.
It's like, no, I don't think you need to talk to my wife.
Right, right. So it's a real thing, but it's not the only thing, because it's very often like, conservative women have been extremely active and extremely motivated. Look at the roles on the, the great book, Mothers of Mass Resistance. Look at the role that white women played in aggressively, actively, and energetically standing up against school integration.
Yeah.
Right. And it's white women who are at the doors of the schools, right? The protectors of their children, their children's white experience within a public school system. And they were there, and they weren't following their husbands there. They were there. The same can be true of Phyllis Schlafly and her army of women who, with like a devotion of 1,000, you know, armies, came to stop the ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment and won in 1982. Those women were operating, they very firmly felt, in their own best interest.
Yeah. Did you have a question, Matt?
I don't think I really had another question, because I was thinking about abortion specifically, but that might be a...
too big of a... We should talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, maybe the way into the abortion question, which, you know, we don't have to obviously settle or talk about...
No, I think we should get to the bottom of this today.
Yeah, we'll settle it.
We'll fix it.
But it is maybe... I don't want to say it's a different issue, but it's like it's... It directly affects women, right? So it's not the conservative women who are pro-life, anti-abortion. They're not kind of voting based on, again, the candidate who will bring their husband's factory job back. I was thinking with Sarah Palin in particular, the fact that she carried to term and had a Down syndrome baby was such a huge part, I think, of her appeal to the right. And, you know, I mean, they brought that baby out at the convention. I remember that imagery
sure
so specifically.
Yep.
But I was thinking, too, of a family member of mine who you know, voted for Trump. And it was interesting. She made a comment to me. I forget whether it was before or after the election. But she said that it was especially troubling to her that Hillary was pro-choice because she was a woman. That Hillary, as a mom, could countenance certain views on abortion. But I'm kind of interested in people like her, or some of the people on the right who maybe are more pundits or intellectuals or whatever, who, you know, the pro-life women of conservatism, and how, I don't know, just what your read is on them. But it seems like it's a wrinkle to the conversation we were just having, and that it's, you know, it is, of course, a part of a patriarchal system, but it's very directly affecting these women in a way that I think, you know, again, talking about how they might want their husband's factory job to come back, it's a slightly different issue. And the appeal of some of these women on the right is, you know, like the Shelby Steele or the John McWhorter kind of African-Americans who are more conservative and say, you know, dissent from certain progressive views. The women on the right who dissent from the pro-choice position, it's because they're women that kind of gives them some of their standing on the right and the usefulness of them, you know, in the broader conservative media ecosystem.
Right. So I can't get to the bottom. It's deeply complicated and I can't get to the bottom, but a couple things that I think about as I listen to you talk about this, you know, all kinds of polling in recent years has found that actual support for banning of abortion is much lower than we thought it was, right? That like, if you go and you ask the questions in a way, like you personally versus like, how do you personally feel about abortion? You get, you know, whatever the old numbers have been, like 50-50, right?
Uh-huh.
Then do you want to see Roe overturned? And when you start separating the, like, how do you feel personally versus your policy investment, what you get is like 70% support for some form of legal abortion, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yet over years, because there was this sort of rudimentary bad polling done for a very, very long time that left us with this belief that this was this 50-50 intractable split.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we still hear this, like, this is the thing we'll never get over as a country, when in fact polling really suggests this. This is even in like even in really purple slash red states, you get that 70% number of support for like some basic legal availability of abortion, mm-hmm. right? And yet, what we also know is true from your lived experience, from lots of our lived experience, are lots of people who will tell you that they're single issue abortion voters. And this is one of the things that I'm always sort of like trying to make sense of. And when it comes to women, especially, I think that an anti-abortion, like I think there are very few areas where women are presumed to have a moral authority when it comes to politics.
Mm, that's a good point.
Right? Mm-hmm. And I also think that some of the appeals there, like feminism in a contemporary form, despite all the ways it's vilified and made monstrous on the right, is also, there's something very appealing for women. Like nobody wants to be the person who's like, I'm for oppression and subjugation, right? Like you, right. So which is why the sort of like pop language of feminism gets spread to the, like choose my choice feminism, right? Gets spread. And you've even seen that, like, I choose to be anti-abortion, right? You know, like, mm-hmm. right. That's why choice language actually is so flaccid and bad,
right.
To my mind. Because people want to use a kind of pop language of, and I don't mean just pop, like language, and think that they're on the side of empowerment, freedom, liberty, expansion, the future, right? And people want to think that even if their views are fundamentally really conservative.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a couple things. First, women are always turned to on the abortion question. I can't tell you, as somebody who writes about politics, the number of times that, like, in a basic early conversation about politics, the assumption is made that, like, the beginning of my investment in left politics is abortion.
Yeah.
Right?
Hopefully we're not, like, doing that.
No, you're not. We're very late.
But we are two men who shouldn't necessarily opine on abortion all the time.
No. Well, no, you should opine on abortion. Like, right? Like, people, the point is, abortion is among the many crucial issues facing us. And we should all be thinking about it all the time, right? Like, we also are thinking about guns and healthcare. And
I agree with that.
Right? But on the right, especially because of some of the gender dynamics that we talked about earlier, where in fact the value of women who are willing to support a right-wing agenda on abortion, as in everything else, is high within a community of the right wing, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. If you're the woman who's willing to make, like, as a woman, mm-hmm. like, not only willing, eager to make an anti-abortion argument, you're a very valuable commodity mm-hmm. within your political community.
Mm-hmm.
So, A, you're taken extremely seriously.
Mm-hmm.
B, the conversation, I believe on the left wing, it has a very strong moral valence that too many on the left are unwilling to just take ownership of, right? Like that the position in favor of reproductive rights and justice is a deeply moral and correct position that I would like to fully own as moral and correct and not run away from.
Yeah.
But on the right, the left is still very hesitant about that, right? Always too scared that it's going to be making a pro-abortion argument. Like, I'm all for that, right? Like, make pro-abortion argument, and it's a moral argument. It's on the side of families, life, health, and happiness.
Yeah.
But on the right, that path is much easier,
mm-hmm.
right? The path, because in a right-wing anti-abortion ideology, it's established that this is a morally correct, pious, if you're a religious person, and for those who deeply believe that it is the humane and pro-woman position to have.
Mm-hmm.
And so any political argument that you can make, that you can make with moral surety, winds up feeling strong,
yeah,
to you as a person who's, and then when you take into effect that then your value into account, the fact that you then become valuable within your political community, and that it's something that you're regarded as competent in talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I think that these factors combine to make it really central to a lot of conservative women's desire to describe why they are where they are politically.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And that doesn't mean it's fake, right? I'm not suggesting that this is all, like, I think that this is, imagine what it's like to be turned to on this.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
To be valued and taken seriously on this subject, to be told, to be reassured that in fact you are the authority here.
Yeah.
For women on all political sides, this is not, I'm not disparaging a right wing over a left wing. It is so rare
right.
to be turned to as a political authority.
Yeah.
And And imagine that on a right, what that would feel like. And it, and surely it happens around abortion more than almost any other topic on the right.
It seems plausible to me that Elizabeth Warren could be the Democratic nominee in 2020. Then we have Elizabeth Warren versus Donald Trump. and obviously there's, you know, there's these people who say, who are saying, men and women saying, well, it can't be Warren because, like, we tried and this country's too sexist and she'll lose. But also there's the sort of, like, you know, there's this idea that she's already gone around with him and lost because of the Native American stuff. But on the other hand, like, there are other ways of imagining what that contest looks like. And I guess maybe I would ask you, like, what are your fears and what are your hopes about what that contest could look like?
My fears and my hopes are so extreme in both directions.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine every worst fear that you have and then, like, multiply it by a factor of, this would be my third presidential race covering a woman, and you have what my fears are.
Yes, okay.
But honestly, take whatever you might imagine my hopes would be and multiply that by a factor of, I've never seen a candidate like this before.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you can imagine what my hopes might be.
Yeah. Right.
Like, I mean, I don't know how else to, I mean, this is, I'm, it's more than a year out and I'm not sleeping. Like, I don't know what to tell you. Yeah. It's, yeah. I don't know that she'll be the nominee.
Sure.
You know, some of the things that I think I mentioned earlier in the conversation, I am regularly surprised as someone who has covered women in presidential politics. Probably as steadily as anybody, things that I didn't think were possible for a woman candidate to do at this stage, I'm startled by her ability to do them. It's at true. The same yeah. time, I thought the DNA, the choice to take that DNA test and put the video out about it was one of the biggest unforced errors I've ever seen in presidential politics. And
own goal.
I did not believe that she would recover from it. So that's among my surprises, is that she's recovered from it.
True.
So all of that is to say that, though I speak, when it comes to women in presidential politics, I probably have about as much as expertise in contemporary politics as anybody. But you're also talking to somebody who's just been completely surprised by any number of things that have already happened around her candidacy. Mm-hmm. And more surprised about her candidacy than the candidacies of some of the other women.
Yeah.
You know, and that's really interesting. There were six women mm-hmm. running for the presidency.
Yeah.
And when it comes to some of my worst fears about how they were going to be received, like, I mean, and this is not to say that I wanted some of them to be received better than they were, right? Like, there are a lot of them that I don't care for. But, like, they've followed much more traditional. Like, the reception of them, I feel like, has been in line with some of the worst expectations for how female candidates are received.
Yeah.
And that's not been true so far, I don't think, with Elizabeth Warren, which is not to say that there's not all kinds of gendered bullshit and sexism that frames her candidacy at this point. I mean, we can, let's, I have me back another time,
okay,
and we
yeah.
can talk
yeah,
about the dishonesty we'll have- frame, the frame of dishonesty.
Oh, yeah.
Like, there's so much gendered stuff that happens around her, but it's not gone the way I thought it was going to go at all.
Yeah.
And so I hesitate to make, I have every fear you can imagine mm-hmm. about how it will go from here on out. And actually more hopes than I could have imagined
yeah.
coming in
wow.
for how it might go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Matt, did you want to say?
Yeah. Well, you know, this gives me, one thing maybe that will give you a little hope or add to the hope, or that kind of made me sit up a little straighter and take notice, was I think it was in the very last debate. Do you remember when Joe Biden tried to take credit for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, or like?
Yes, I do remember. I do remember that. I briefly lost consciousness, but yes, I do remember that. Yes.
Warren's reply to that was so striking. Do you remember she paused, gathered herself, and then delivered that utterly cutting line about thanking Obama for all the work he did to you know, enable her to kind of put the Consumer Protection Financial Bureau into practice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, I mean, there was something about that line and the way she delivered it that was like, she might be able to pull this off. She owned that man, yeah. You know? And I really thought, and I really just kind of thought that there was something about that. Maybe, of course, it could cut both ways, you know, but there was, I just hadn't seen something quite like that before.
So, yeah. One of the things that I always think about with Warren is that she's relatively new to politics, mm-hmm. but she's lived her entire career in law schools and especially in the second half of her career at very elite institutions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where I'm pretty sure that she's had some version of that conversation mm-hmm. senior dude like tried to tell her that she should be grateful that you know, he helped her succeed. I'm sure because like I don't work at elite law schools and I've had a hundred of those conversations.
Yeah.
So like I looked at that and I was like, she's done this before. Right.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
there's you cannot underestimate the amount of practice, women have had in dealing with douchebags. But, I also just keep waiting. I have to say, like, for me, if this endless stream of debates is like a television show, like for me, the season finale is her and Biden going to bankruptcy. Like that, because that, like, that's the one I don't want it to happen too early. Uh-huh. Like, I just want it to be at the end. And I mean, these two have the other thing that we forget is that even before she got into politics, she has history with Joe Biden condescending to her, right? You guys have to go back, and anybody who's listening to this, watch the clip of them. I think it's 2002.
I love this. I know. I hate it, but the you're very good professor.
Chuckling. Uh-huh. You're very good uh-huh. professor. Fuck you! She doesn't say that. She doesn't say fuck uh-huh. you.
Yeah.
She smiles and nods at him, right? So yes, she's totally good at this. But let me say that, like, yes, she can cut Donald Trump into, you know, 45,000 very small pieces. That's fine. I want to say something that's a little bit of a downer about that.
Okay.
And it goes, circles back to like a very early part of this conversation about, did Hillary just blow it against the worst candidate ever, right? Hillary Clinton cut him into 45,000 pieces.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Over three mm-hmm. debates, right? So yeah. This is always an argument, and it's one I hear a lot about Warren. She could tear into him, about Kamala Harris, who undoubtedly could tear him apart in the debates.
Yeah.
I don't know that the metric of being able to unman Donald Trump, and not just unman him, like just tear him to shreds, debates that, like, I think there are actually a number of Democratic candidates who will be very good at ruining him on a debate stage because he is an incompetent toddler and mm-hmm. they're very smart, right? Yeah. There are a number of candidates who could do that. I think Bernie Sanders could tear him apart. I think Warren certainly could. I think Harris could. And that's true. You're absolutely right. And you have every reason to feel optimistic about that. My anxiety is that we've already seen it demonstrated that the ability to
that's true
beat Donald Trump like a drum, as Joe Biden might say, three debates in a row didn't take us to a result where the person who beat him won the election, right?
And to be even more, and this is again related back to things we've been talking about, maybe when you unman him, when a woman unmans him, it is at that moment that the revanchist impulse of the men who support him is most ignited. That's me in that moment being undermined.
That certainly is happening in like the cerebral cortexes of tons of people. Absolutely. But I would say that most of those are already activated, like before the debate starts. Like most of the very act of running to beat Donald Trump, it is going to be an affront and an assault to all kinds of people who don't want
it. If I'm not mistaken, he has agreed to actually have his balls cut off if he loses. Yeah.
Right. But wait, I want to say the one, because that's a downer for me to say, like, it doesn't matter who can beat him on a debate stage. The one thing I want to say, and it goes back to, you know, sort of the person that I look to. So I don't think the key to winning, if there is a key to winning, is the ability to beat him. Because, like, truly, like, I have a 4-year-old who could do the job if called upon. It's the expansion of an electorate, which is, of course, exactly what the party, not just Donald Trump, but the right wing, and not just Donald Trump era right wing. It's what the party's, the Republican Party's project has been, you know, basically since 1964, 1965, is the rollback, rollback of the franchise. And so, yeah. But that's the thing we have to look for in a candidate. If you're asking me what we have to look for, it is that ability to expand, to bring new people in. Because with the people who've already voted, like the people who are like, we know which candidate is better. Mm-hmm. Like everybody, we know who can beat Donald Trump. It's not that. It has to be somebody who can generate excitement, hope, belief, you know, and do I believe, and yes, I again think there are a couple candidates who could plausibly do this, just a couple. I think that Warren has that ability. Yes, I think she's one of them, and it's down to a lot of the things that, we've been talking about here, the combination of fight, competence, plans. Like, I actually think that there is a universe, this is where my hope hinges, right? Where all those things, that the fruit that those things bear is an ability to reach out and bring in more people.
Yeah. And, you know, we haven't, I mean, we saw with the midterms something of what you describe in your book, in Good and Mad, what can be accomplished by harnessing and believing in and unleashing women's anger, but we haven't had a chance to see it up against Trump.
Right. And by the way, we should all be taking that seriously. I mean, one thing that you don't see in political punditry and horse race coverage, people do not want to take the women, not just the women candidates in 2018 who won this historic number of seats, but the women who did the door knocking, the voter registration, who were giving up their nights and weekends. And that's part of what I'm writing about in Good Mad. And I have been stunned by the, like,
it's a field operation.
It is a massive field operation that is far more skilled than the highly paid consultants who are going out there and designing the, like, actual official field operations. I mean, and there were examples of that all over the place. And it's something that bugs me every single day, in the same way that both political parties, and I think especially the Democratic Party, actually, because again, on the right wing, they value women because women are willing to uphold, you know, those dynamics. But the Democratic Party, which still is running away from being called the mommy party, by the way, which is something that it was labeled in the 70s and has been running away from ever since. The Democratic Party doesn't fundamentally want to take its female base, which is, of course, majority, not white. But also it's white activist women, white middle-class women recently awakened. They still just want to think of them as like soccer moms or whatever stupid term was coined for them 30 years ago. And they don't understand that they're actually engines of franchise expansion, that they're door knockers, that they are the field operation, right? Nobody in the party wants to take that seriously. Nobody on television news wants to take that seriously. They all just want to comfortably talk about soccer moms or whatever white suburban women are going to do as if it's a footnote. And there is not an acknowledgement of the raw power of what it means to have women activated via their anger, which is what I was writing about in Good and Mad, which is what we saw the fruits of in the 2018 midterms. And still no one's taking it seriously going into 2020, except I think a few of the candidates, Elizabeth Warren among them.
Well, that might be a good note to end on.
We could obviously go on.
Yeah.
But we shouldn't.
Well, you've been extremely generous with your time.
I just have to go make lasagna now.
Yeah. Sam and I are both very grateful for that. And this was really a fantastic conversation. And we're just very appreciative. And I'm sure our listeners will be too.
Definitely.
Thank you so much. It was fun.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good. Glad you had fun. It wasn't painful.
No.
Or not exclusively painful.
That was not exclusively painful.
Yeah. All right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.